Excuse me?
It's okay to record you?
Yeah.
I am Celia Sharp. I was in research for many years, especially in NIH. And I had very good encounters with PETA when I was there.
I'm Daniel. I graduated undergrad in 2010. I'm a full-time MBA student. And I'm applying to medical school for next year.
I'm Caroline. I just graduated in the spring from Villanova, so right around the corner from Markham. And I'm full-time in the MBA program.
My name's Greg Lipinski. I'm the biosafety officer for WISTAR.
I'm Beth Brenner. I'm a master's in nursing and hopefully a master's in bioethics too.
Hi, I'm Marita Papadopoulos. Work here at the University of Penn in the Center for Epidemiology and Biostats. Work for an epidemiologist.
Victor.
Victor White, a student on the MSc program.
I'm Mark. I just finished my first year of medical school, so I guess I'm in second year. Haven't done much basic science research, but I'm doing some right now. That's why I've been posturing myself as a good doctor.
Hi, I'm Allie. I just graduated from Penn in May, and I'm a full-time MBA student.
I'm Ken Clothen. I'm a lawyer and have served in government for many years. But prior to that, did basic research in neuroscience and studied the history of medicine.
I'm Daphne, a first-year dental resident, doing my master's in oral biology.
I'm Alex Klettner. I'm a first-year PhD student at UPenn, doing cell molecular biology.
My name is Russell. I'm a nurse anesthetist and in the PhD program with a dual degree here.
I'm Shauna Benston. I'm a full-time MBA student and going to law school in the fall. And I went to Shipley for high school, so literally across the street.
Right.
I'm Larissa. I just started bioethics here this summer, and I'm going to law school this fall.
I'm a rising 3L in law school and a full-time MBA student. Oh, back.
I'm Vijay. I work at Penn Women's Cancer Research.
I'm Sally Thompson. I'm the regulatory affairs manager in the Department of Surgery. I've worked on
IV protocols. I'm John Fair. I'm a half-time MBA student and a consultant to pharma.
So let me collect the papers.
All right.
Two copies, huh?
Yes,
two copies. One.
I forgot.
You have table.
I forgot the...
Excuse me? There, I have handouts over there. If you didn't pick one up, in the center of the table are two handouts. One's the PowerPoint slides, and then the other is just some data that updates one of the PowerPoint slides.
How did this chair go up? I sat down in the sun.
I have no idea what I'm doing here.
Way better.
Good. I ask you.
I just
I'll work on it.
Sorry. Okay, thanks. If anybody comes in late, I think we're all here.
Okay.
Send them back to me.
All right.
I'll see you in a while.
Okie doke. Well, thank you all for coming tonight. I hope everyone's picked up the two handouts. One of them is my PowerPoint slides, and the other is some more updated information than my third PowerPoint slide. I'm Nadine Hackman. I'm a veterinarian. I did graduate from this program, and I usually do this presentation with Lily Duda, who is another veterinarian. She's the radiation oncologist at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, and I direct the veterinary technology program at Harcum College, which is a two-year school in Bryn Mawr. And if you don't own a pet, then veterinary technicians are nurses in veterinary medicine. So, there's more than 100,000 years of evidence of man's use of animals, and there have been controversies about their use since recorded history. This presentation, in particular, looks at the use of animals in biomedical research and the issues that surround that. This slide is just an overview of the presentation. Our institutional use of animals, which is on the slide as one of the bullets, means, for this presentation, biomedical research, but perhaps you've heard of factory farming, the intensive way that animals are raised in animal agriculture, and so that could also be considered an institutionalized use of animals. What's interesting, though, is that the Animal Welfare Act, which is the law that governs the use of animals in research, specifically excludes animals in animal agriculture, and just so that everyone's clear on what we mean by that. Animals that are used in agriculture would be animals used or intended for use as food, fiber, or when used or intended for use in agricultural research such as improving animal nutrition, breeding, management, production efficiency, or for improving the quality of food or fiber. When these very same animals are used in biomedical research, however, they are covered by the provisions of the Animal Welfare Act. It's just when they're on a farm that they're not. All right. This So perhaps this happened because I made this on a PC and it's coming to you off of a Mac, but it's just as well, because this table is really dated. It's from 1997, and what it looks at is the number of animals. I don't know, can you see, if you can read it better, you can read it better on the PowerPoint slides. It looks at the number of animals used in this country, not only in research, but also comparing that to owned animals, you know, owned as pets, and then the numbers that are slaughtered for food. So only 0.5% of the animals that are used in this country are used in research. So I'm not saying two wrongs make a right, but if PETA really wanted to do something about the misery index of animals in this country, if they would take a weekend off from protesting about the use of animals in research and attempt to say something about animals that are used in animal agriculture, it would be a whole lot more meaningful in terms of the lives of the animals involved. You may or may not be able to see on the slide that, and these are from 1997, which is why I say it's an old slide. The person who I got this from used to use it in a presentation he did to my students, and then he quit using the slide, so I never bother to update it on my own. But it looks at the number of owned dogs and cats, you know, in the 50 millions, and then the number of dogs and cats that are killed in shelters at around 15 million. So again, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. Depending upon where the statistics come from, anywhere between 10% to 25% of healthy dogs and cats in this country are euthanized because of the pet overpopulation problem. Because this slide is so old, then there's a little two-page handout handout that I gave you with some information that I found more recently. And so we've got animals used in research, experiments, and testing, teaching in fiscal year 2007. Underneath that, we have the numbers of animals that have their pain and distress relieved or not. And then the flip side, it just looks at the number of animals used in research from the first reporting year, which would have been 1973, till the time I collected this information, which was the year 2007. And so in general, the use of all species has declined. Declining the least or maybe not at all would be primates. The number of primates used has remained amazingly consistent. And then the last little table on the last page would be households owning pets. Usually the way you hear some of these statistics is that there are more cats that are pets in this country than dogs. About 10 years ago, cats surpassed dogs as being the most numerous house pet. But in general, when people own cats, they own more than one. So because this looks at households, there are more dog-owning households than there are cat-owning households, but more people own cats than dogs. So, just some statistics. All right, the next few slides talk about the religious basis for our feelings about using animals in research. And Western attitudes towards animals have their roots in the traditions of Judaism and Greek antiquity, which unite in Christianity. The Old Testament says that God made man in his own image, and if only man is godlike, then only man can have a special position in the universe. So, Genesis chapter 1, 24 to 28 verse. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish in the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, all over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." Dominion can be taken to mean sovereignty, although there are scattered passages like in Isaiah 66:3, "He who slaughters an ox is like him who kills a man," that encourage some degree of kindness to animals. So it can be argued that dominion is really more like stewardship. Nevertheless, in the Old Testament, there was no serious challenge to the overall view laid down in Genesis that humans are the pinnacle of creation and we have God's permission to kill and eat other animals. The second ancient tradition of Western thought is that of Greece, with the most important school being that of Plato and his pupil Aristotle. Aristotle holds that animals exist to serve the purposes of human beings, although unlike Genesis, he does not drive any deep gulf between humans and the rest of the animal world. Aristotle does not deny that man is an animal, rather though he is a rational animal, but sharing a common animal nature doesn't justify equal consideration. Nature is a hierarchy, and those with less reasoning ability exist for the sake of those with more. And to quote, "Since nature makes nothing purposeless or in vain, it is undeniably true that she has made all animals for the sake of man." Scoring points only for referring to nature as a female. Christianity unites Jewish and Greek ideas about animals. The New Testament is completely devoid of any injunction against cruelty to animals or any recommendation to consider their interests. If any single writer may be taken as representative of Christian philosophy prior to the Reformation and of Roman Catholic philosophy to this day, it would be Thomas Aquinas. He incorporated Aristotle's ideas into Christian doctrine, and for him, not only is it lawful for man to kill animals, cruelty to irrational animals is not wrong in itself. Charity even does not extend to irrational creatures. He does propose, though, that the reason to not be cruel to animals is that it may lead to cruelty to human beings. And this is a justification against animal cruelty that is still used today, that it will have a brutalizing effect on the humans. These ideas persisted up until 1988, when the authoritative statement from the Roman Catholic Church indicated that the environmental movement was beginning to affect Catholic teachings. And Pope John Paul II stated that the dominion granted to man by the Creator is not an absolute power. When it comes to the material world, we are subject to biological laws, but also to moral ones. All right, the philosophical basis. The first half of the 17th century was caught up in the new and exciting science of mechanics. Descartes held that everything that consisted of matter was governed by mechanistic principles like those that governed a clock. He overcame the obvious problem that man's body is made out of matter and so part of the physical universe by bringing in the idea of the soul. There are two kinds of things in the universe, things of the spirit or soul, as well as things of physical or material nature. And human beings are conscious, and consciousness couldn't have its origins in matter. So Descartes identified consciousness as the immortal soul, and only human beings have souls. Thus, animals without souls were therefore without consciousness as well. They were mere machines or automata. They experienced neither pleasure nor pain, and when cut with a knife, they squealed, but this doesn't mean they feel pain. Governed by the same principles as a clock, it was only a noise as if a spring had been touched. It was at this time that experiments on animals became widespread in Europe, and since there were no anesthetics and would be none for another 200 years, Descartes' theory allowed experimenters to dismiss any qualms they might have had about their animal subjects feeling any pain. And Kant formulated the classic version of deontological or duty theory. According to him, insofar as animals are concerned, we have no direct duties. Rather, our duties to animals are indirect duties towards humanity. Animals have only instrumental value, morally speaking. Now, ironically, the vogue for experimenting on animals may have been in part responsible for changing attitudes towards animals, because the experiments revealed the remarkable similarities between the anatomy and physiology of animals and humans. The quotation on the slide comes from Bentham's Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. He compared the position of animals to that of black slaves. Bentham was the first to denounce man's dominion as tyranny rather than legitimate governance. In 1859, Darwin published The Origin of the Species. He waited more than 10 years after the idea of evolution had come to be accepted as a legitimate scientific claim before he published The Descent of Man in 1871 and made the connection between man and the other animals explicit. And if man was no longer separate from other animals, the foundations of the entire Western way of thinking of the place of man in the world was undermined. This is similar to the undermining that occurred when the earth was found to not be the center of the universe. And Peter Singer, a utilitarian philosopher at Princeton, has said, "Only those who prefer religious faith to beliefs based on reasoning and evidence can still maintain that the human species is the special darling of the entire universe, that animals were created to provide us with food, or that we have divine authority over them and divine permission to kill them." The history of the institutional use of animals. American medicine adopted the model of experimental medicine from Germany as early as the 1870s, and any research that produced knowledge was important. The discovery of anesthesia in the 1840s, the hypodermic needle, the stethoscope, the x-ray in 1895, all of these held enormous promise for therapeutic advances. Any research that produced knowledge was important, and medical practice based on science gave regular physicians more authority over such quacks as homeopaths or bleeders. In 1847, the American Medical Association organized in order to protect physicians' privilege, but by 1898, the AMA started its defense of research. Formal opposition to the use of animals in research had started 30 years earlier in 1866. Because before there was experimental medicine, the physician's only concern was for his patient's well-being. But once experimental medicine was embraced, the physician had a conflict between his patient's interests and the researcher's interests in experimental and control subjects. Whereas conventional thinking held that the character of the researcher ensured appropriate ethical behavior by virtue of a physician's educational and moral standing, by 1907, to accommodate experimental medicine into clinical patient care, rules governing research included that any new procedure must be proved safe on animals first was put forth, and that would be William Osler who said that. By the way, if anyone has a question, you can feel free to interrupt me. The next slide is about anti-vivisection. Vivisection literally means to perform surgery without anesthesia, but has been used more generally to refer to any experimentation on animals. Henry Berg founded the first American SPCA in 1866. The following year, Carolyn Earl White founded the Pennsylvania SPCA, and the year after that, George T. Angel founded the Massachusetts SPCA, and that was followed by many more. Although the ASPCA care about animal welfare in general, their particular concern was for the use of animals in research. Concern was that cruelty to animals during experimentation would lead to less compassion reflected in patient care, that using animals in research would have a brutalizing effect on a person that would be manifested by seeing patients as less than human and less than deserving of compassion. And this was what Thomas Aquinas put forth in the 13th century. In 1874, the ASPCA applied the laws concerning animal abuse to the case of a child, Mary Ellen Wilson, a victim of child abuse. And as a result, in 1875, after the formation of the ASPCA, the New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children was founded. concern about cruelty to animals extending to cruelty to humans and the possible utilitarian benefits gained from this type of research was a separate issue from the morality per se of using animals. Protection of both animals and people for medical experimentation was seen as a single goal. The ASPCA felt the duty was to decrease the pain and suffering of animals that serve man, and this concept of stewardship allows for man's use of animals but comes with a duty to use them appropriately. But by 1883, Carolyn White, who started the Pennsylvania SPCA in 1867, in 1883, she advocated the abolition of animal usage in all forms and started the American Anti-Vivisection Society. This group was historically concerned with lab animals, but general animal welfare as well. The shipping of cattle, water troughs for horses, animal ambulances, bird plumage, and leg hold traps. All of these things concern the Anti-Vivisection Society. And in terms of water troughs for horses, in a city like New York, at least 20 horses a day died between 1880 and 1885 in their role as transportation and beasts of burden. Regulations that pertain to the use of animals in research. The Animal Welfare Act was first enacted in 1966. It's enforced by APHIS, which is the acronym for the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. There are two parts to it. The Animal Welfare Act would be under APHIS Veterinary Services, and this would be under the United States Department of Agriculture. The use of animals in research happens to be the third most regulated industry in the United States, behind airlines and the pharmaceutical industry. One of the bullets says that it was initially passed in response to the seizure of pound animals. Pound seizure laws refer to the repurchase of animals from animal shelters and selling them to research facilities. And these laws were motivated by reports that pet animals were being stolen and used for research. This was detailed in a Life magazine expose about Pepper the Dalmatian. The Animal Welfare Act has been amended several times. Each of the amendments have made it more inclusive. So in 1970, veterinary care during research was mandated. In 1976, airline containers and the conditions for animals on airlines were specified. 1985 mandated exercise for dogs, psychological well-being for non-human primates, and the formation of IACUCS, which stands for an Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee that I'll talk more about. And the 1991 amendments had performance standards like SOPs replacing physical standards in governing the inspection process. That animals used in agriculture are exempt from the parts of the Animal Welfare Act, the regulations of the Animal Welfare Act, I've already mentioned. And in terms of experimental design, the Act covers humane handling, care, treatment, and transportation of animals. In other words, how the research will treat or affect an animal, and the circumstances under which the animal is maintained. But the Animal Welfare Act does not cover the evaluation of the design, the outlines, the guidelines, and the scientific merit of the proposed research. And then the second bullet, a former Secretary of Agriculture in 1970 arbitrarily excluded birds, rats, and mice from the category of animal as defined under the Animal Welfare Act. Part of the rationale for this decision was the fact that 90% of animals used in research are mice and rats, and so excluding them would greatly facilitate the administration of the regulations. For reference purposes, in the year 2000, there were only 80 USDA inspectors assigned to enforce the Animal Welfare Act, so not covering 90% of the animals would certainly make it easier. Mice and rats are covered under the Public Health Service policy that I will get to in a few minutes. In 1992, amendments separated wild versus lab-bred rats and mice, so wild mice and rats would be covered. And in June 2004, an amendment separated wild from lab-bred birds, so wild birds would be covered. There was a successful lawsuit by the Alternatives Research and Development Foundation, the ARDF on the slide, and an advocacy campaign by the American Anti-Vivisection Society that resulted in a USDA decision to grant full legal protection to mice, rats, and birds under the Animal Welfare Act. Not surprisingly, when the original petition was made, the USDA received over 40,000 public comments, more than any animal issue ever, with 94% of the comments favoring inclusion of the animals. Not only that, a majority of researchers and institutions also supported their inclusion, as did 75% of IACUC members. However, a House Senate Conference Committee amendment to the fiscal year 2001 Agricultural Appropriations Bill included language to prevent or at least delay this change by not allocating funding that would be required to write the regulations. And in 2002, Jesse Helms sponsored an amendment to the Farm Bill that the Animal Welfare Act would specifically exempt mice and rats. This was passed in February of 2002 and is known as the Helms Amendment. As for the provisions of the Animal Welfare Act, the 1966 definition of an animal was live or dead dogs, cats, monkeys, non-human primate mammals, guinea pigs, hamsters, and rabbits. In 1970, it was amended to include other warm-blooded animals, as the Secretary of the USDA may determine, and he determined to exclude birds, rats, and mice. Currently, the definition of an animal is any warm-blooded animal other than those specifically exempted that is being used or intended for use for research, testing, experimentation, or exhibition purposes, or as a pet. Exhibition includes carnival circuses and zoos, but not pet stores, horse and dog races, rodeos, farm and livestock shows and fairs. Provisions also include that there's an attending veterinarian responsible for overseeing the care and use of the animals, including training of personnel and guidance in animal care matters, use of pain-relieving drugs, adequate pre- and post-procedural care, including euthanasia, animal behavior, and well-being. In terms of the definition of pain, the 1985 amendment was concerned with minimizing pain and distress, and the Act defines a painful procedure in terms of human standards of pain. So pain in excess of that caused by injections or other minor procedures, unless the absence is justified for scientific reasons. In other words, if it hurts a person, assume that it hurts an animal. In 2000, the USDA ask for comments on the definition of reporting in distress, which was previously undefined. So they defined pain in human terms, but distress was never defined. And no changes in the policy have resulted, so distress remains still undefined. But likewise has also elicited thousands of public comments.
I'm sorry, I had a question because I would like to know if this includes when they say dogs and rats, and does that include just the animals that are used for research or any wild rats?
It would be, I believe, when used for research. So if you were studying animals in their natural setting, those wild animals would be under the provisions of the Animal Welfare Act. But it would still be legal to hunt animals because that wouldn't, in the same way that the animals of animal agriculture remain uncovered, so would wild animals, unless they're being used in research or exhibition or teaching. The act initially focused on physical requirements such as cage size and airflow. And you know, that's not to say that there aren't other laws that protect wild animals. I mean, there's the Endangered Species Act. So certain animals are exempt from being hunted, you know, because their numbers are so low. And there are laws that prevent overt cruelty to animals, independent of the Animal Welfare Act. The act initially focused on physical requirements such as cage size and airflow, but the focus changed to performance standards such as psychological well-being, things like making allowances for natural behavior and social grouping, and veterinary care and analgesia. Consideration of alternatives was stipulated in the 1985 amendment. The primary investigator must submit a written assurance that the activity does not unnecessarily duplicate previous experiments. And Russell and Birch, in 1959, introduced the concept of the three R's, replace, reduce, and refine. Replacing animals includes using non-living alternatives such as tissue culture or computer animals or computer models rather, or animals lower on the phylogenetic scale. Reducing the number of animals used would be accomplished by improved experimental techniques. And refine the procedure is the most likely to be used and refers to diminishing the amount of pain and degree of reducing or diminishing the amount and degree of pain, suffering, and stress experienced by the animals. As for the IACUC, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, these have been mandated since the 1985 amendment. Their purpose is that rather than the USDA judging the merit of research, every facility using animals in research would have their own IACUC, and so you would have local rather than central control of ideas, which seems like a good idea. IACUCs must meet at least every 6 months. Their functions include inspection of facilities, review of standard operating procedures, and they do have the authority to evaluate the merits of the research. The protocol review includes the purpose and justification of the experiment, the justification for the species and their number, evaluation of the degree in suffering, the degree of suffering, the analgesics and anesthetics that will be used, and the endpoint of the experiment, including euthanasia, as well as the quality of handling and justification for departures from the SOPs. The members are appointed by the institution with a minimum of 4 members. Those 4 members need to include 1 veterinarian with laboratory animal science experience and 1 outside member. However, there are no provisions for quality control of IACUC review. Although they are authorized to evaluate the merits of the research, the committee members may have little to no training beyond that required of the veterinarian. They may have no ethics training, no training in evaluating scientific protocols, and no training in assessing animal suffering. It's up to the research institution to provide the training and education of the IACUC members. Compounding this problem is that there is no consensus as to the moral status of animals, not only among the general public and researchers, but even among veterinarians. There is a conflict of interest among the members, as most are from the institution itself. And there's no defined ethical analysis required because there's no accepted ethical theory by which to judge the appropriateness of animal use. For example, should we judge the scientific use of animals based on individual interests, suffering, rights, human stewardship, or kinship with animals? The IACUC's primary mandated concern is the prevention of animal suffering, yet there's no consensus on the nature, recognition, or moral significance of animal suffering. And the committees are not required to weigh animal suffering against the value of the research. Other regulations, I made mention of the Public Health Service policy. They have a policy on humane care and use of laboratory animals. This was mandated by the 1985 Health Research Extension Act. Originally, it was part of the Office for Protection from Research Risks. So, ironically, the protection of human subjects increases the use of animals in research. But about 12 or 13 years ago, it was moved to NIH. This policy only applies to recipients of federal funds, not private companies. However, ALAC, which is an acronym that stands for the Association for Assessment and Accreditation of Laboratory Animal Care, was begun in 1965, and they seem to pick up the slack. While accreditation by ALAC is voluntary, all large institutions seek accreditation. In addition, also covering all institutions would be the FDA and EPA Good Lab Practices, originally published in 1979. Since the Public Health Service policy is just a policy and not a law, there is no power to enforce or punish. However, they can withhold funding. For reference purposes, in 1998, to the University of Pennsylvania, that would have been $150 million. The policy is similar to the Animal Welfare Act, except that their definition of an animal does include mice and rats. Any live vertebrate animal used or intended for use in research, research training, experimentation, or biological testing, or for related purposes. It is concerned with animal welfare, though, only indirectly. Instead, what it is aimed at is ensuring efficiency and accuracy of tests. So the assumption is that a happy, healthy animal produces better data, with the primary goal being the data and the animal welfare a secondary concern.
I was thinking, why they didn't include the marine animals?
It would include all live vertebrate animals.
Oh, I
so
see.
It'd so, be marine so mammals and even fish.
Zebrafish.
Yeah. This policy requires the use of the Guide for the Care and Use of Laboratory Animals, which is an HHS NIH publication. I brought mine, but I am actually two editions behind the new one. Do you want to, the new one is twice as fat, looks like.
This one's brand new.
Hot off the presses.
You're not that
All right, let's talk about the current ethical theories as they pertain to animals. Utilitarianism is a teleological approach first explicitly articulated by Jeremy Bentham and more fully developed by John Stuart Mill. Good could include pleasure or happiness. Harm could be decreased happiness or pain and suffering. Utilitarianism, as it applies to animal use, would be that although curing human disease seems like an overriding good consequence, since animals can feel pleasure and pain, they must be included in the moral calculus. Peter Singer, now at Princeton, wrote the seminal work on the moral status of animals, Animal Liberation, 1975. Classical utilitarianism issues a challenge to reevaluate our current levels of use of animals in research, although some research is allowable if the benefit is great enough. Deontology is also known as duty theory, and here the emphasis is on a special class of irreducible moral properties or right-making characteristics that make an action correct or right or proper. Different deontological theories vary widely on the issue of the moral status of animals and their use in research. Immanuel Kant formulated the classical version of deontology, and he believed that we have no direct duties to animals because they have no moral status in God's universe. Therefore, any research that might benefit human moral agents is permissible. But Tom Reagan states in The Case for Animal Rights, which was published in 1983, that some things have value in virtue of the sorts of things that they are, not simply by virtue of their contribution to total world good. And all of what he calls subjects of a life have inherent value, and subjects of a life include sentient animals. Animals have value regardless of their usefulness to people. They are therefore entitled to freedom from harm and freedom from control. If we follow Kant in attributing inherent value to only moral agents, we cannot justify our respect as it applies to infants and the retarded and other incompetent individuals. For a deontologist, right and wrong are not judged by the consequences of a decision. Animal use cannot be justified no matter the benefit. This is in the same way that human research on compromised or undesirable individuals cannot be justified to benefit the good of the rest of human society. And deontological emphasis on respect and justice for the individual underlies our judgment that it's wrong to be callous to animals even when there is no harm to that animal. So, for example, it is considered inappropriate to make fun of research primates even though they are unaware of this action. The deontological arguments also allow us to oppose experimentation in which animals are killed painlessly, which is actually a problem for the utilitarian. A utilitarian would be forced to say that research on animals is permissible if a lab animal's only bad day is its last day. The intuitive feeling of kinship is also known as speciesism, and it implies that we have moral duties only to our own kind. Furthermore, it is natural, appropriate, and moral to feel and act this way. However, this is an overly simplistic approach to morality and ethics. The kinship argument has actually been used to justify all sorts of isms: racism, sexism, and national chauvinism. Speciesism is exactly the same kind of argument. By virtue of our capacity to reason, we have the ability to expand our sphere of moral concern. Where we draw the limits is often a matter of expediency rather than of legitimate moral argument. And the holistic approach melds ethics, what is right and wrong, with metaphysics, the ultimate nature of matter and the world. It holds that all life has inherent moral value of at least some sort. And this approach, as the slide presents, can be utilized in either a utilitarian or rights formulation of ethics. Justification of animal use, the pros and cons. In Western thought, the assumption is that science is the only kind of knowledge. Scientific ideas are validated by controlled experiments requiring multiple subjects, and the results are never complete, but subject to repeated revision. In other traditions, there are other ways of acquiring knowledge. Because multiple subjects are required, and because it's difficult to recruit and utilize humans in experiments, even though they are the appropriate ultimate subject of research, animals are used as substitutes for humans because they are cheap, readily available, expendable, and similar enough to humans in various relevant parameters. The human values of science, as the slide presents, include personal and professional gain, relief of human and animal suffering, the enhancement of well-being, knowledge for knowledge's sake, the civilizing force of knowing, and science as a primary human and ethical good. Animals, at least in Pennsylvania, have only the legal status of property. If we are going to get good data from the use of animals, we are required to provide good care of those animals. All animal life, including humans, by nature uses other organic life to flourish. However, the inherent value of animal and organic life also seems ultimate and underived as compared to the values of science and civilization. So even though by nature humans use other organic life to flourish, it need not by necessity be other animal life. It is an assumption.
Sorry, what do they mean by organic?
Oh, living things. Containing carbon,
mm-hmm.
Just living things. So animal and organic life, I guess animal would probably be more like the public health service policy, vertebrates, and organic life would mean perhaps lower species phylogenetically, or else it's just redundant. It is an assumption, or maybe organic life could mean plants too.
Yeah, I mean.
So even though, you know, by nature humans use other organic life, it does not by necessity mean animals have to be used.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Maybe we should stick with plants. No one's ever asked that. That's probably what I meant when I wrote it. It is an assumption that biomedical good requires animal use. In fact, biomedical good might be obtainable in other ways, although those ways may be considerably less expedient and much more costly. So, problems with animal use. A small but radical group of people argue that independent of the moral status of animals, the current biomedical paradigm is just not good science. That people get harmed by basing human care on extrapolation from animal experiments, with thalidomide being the classic example of that. Many experiments lead nowhere. Science just doesn't work. This position is to be distinguished from a fear of science. Those individuals think that science works, but it's still a bad thing, like the anti-technology Luddites, like Jeremy Rifkin. As for the second bullet, that human welfare might be better served by preventive medicine, educational efforts to change societal habits such as smoking, public health initiatives, physical fitness, and things like that. One peculiar difficulty of animal research is that the better the animal model, the more likely that animal will be cognitively and perhaps morally similar to humans. This is particularly true for psychological experiments. Darwin and the relationship between species cuts both ways. Kinship means animal experiments are relevant for humans. However, the obvious differences between species implies that perhaps there are no good analogies. So to resolve this conflict, what we would want to do would be to inflict the least harm for the particular good sought, that the greater the harm, the stricter and more compelling the ethical justification must be. Specifically, the test of proportionality, that the number and kind of animals used and their suffering be proportionate to the goals of the research. What would be the cost to human or animal or scientific good relative to the ethical cost to the animals if the use was foregone? And are there experiments, no matter how worthy, that are inadmissible due to violation of our moral sensibilities and extreme harm to the animals? And then finally, the last slide is just a comparison of animal rights versus animal welfare, if that hasn't been made explicit so far. The animal rights position is held by such groups as PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. AVAR is the Association of Veterinarians for Animal Rights and the American Anti-Vivisection Society. These groups stand in contrast to the animal welfarists. An animal welfarist believes that man's use of animals is ethically justifiable if it follows certain constraints, such as a duty to decrease pain and suffering, or at least increase the usefulness of the animal's death. This includes not only the use of animals in research, but also for food and recreation. Some animal welfarists believe, in addition, that incremental increases in welfare measures will lead to limited abolition. Others, like Rutgers law professor Gary Francione, see the system as being so corrupt that incrementalism will not work. Instead, the concept of animals as property must be eliminated because a happy slave is still a slave. Yes?
Question. So, I was here about these studies that say that if you have a pet, like a cat, that your blood pressure goes down or something like that. So would animal rightists say that you can't have pets because it's one of the forms, even if it's like a symbiotic, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, literally, I guess.
Right. It is the case that an animal rights person would be interested in the abolition of man's use of all animals. And for the domestic animals, it's possible that they would say that these species wouldn't even exist without man, and that they would probably want the domestic animals to stop being allowed to breed so that they wouldn't require the symbiotic relationship that you describe. Well, that would be unfair. I think it would be considered unfair to release domestic animals into the wild because they've been bred to be different than their wild counterparts. And so I think the animal rights person would just want to stop breeding them and allow them to go extinct.
Yeah, but that doesn't, I mean, that's ahistorical. I mean, cats and humans kind of came together for kind of mutual purpose. I mean, they're using their together, and it works. They kind of want to take care of each other.
Well, that's what he means by a symbiotic relationship, but nevertheless, we're still using them. I mean, it could be that one would just change their, no kidding, that one would just change their legal status. I mean, there are several municipalities, with Rhode Island being the largest entity as a state, that has change the language of animal ownership to animal guardianship. And so, you know, the owner is now the guardian and the pet is the ward. And that language then requires the guardian to always work in the best interests of the ward. So using that language maybe would be suitable for an animal rights person. Believe it or not, veterinary medicine is opposed to guardianship language because, well, first of all, they see it as an insidious way for the animal rights people to shut down the use of animals in research and animal agriculture. But beyond that, because the legal definition of guardian and ward already exists, it might actually be bad for the pet owner. Because right now, if you can't afford a treatment that would save your animal's life, you know, if it's going to end up bankrupting you, you can put the animal to sleep. But guardianship language would require you to treat the animal. Or it could be that guardianship language will be interpreted that if the owner can't afford it, the veterinarian still has to provide the care. And it's never going to be in an animal's best interest to be, you know, to enter the food chain. So there are far-reaching ramifications to the guardianship language. Although it has some appeal to us, who feel that we don't own our animals and that they use us as much as we use them.
Mm-hmm. Sort of by extension, in terms of allowing certain species to just stop being bred and therefore die out over time, would you say that animal rights people would say the same thing about factory farm animals, or would they maybe take more, I don't like the word extreme, but extreme approach, like, just kill them all now, stop their misery where it is now, and stop breeding them? Or I'm not sure how they would approach.
Yeah, I don't know either. And Lily Duda, who is my co-presenter and not here tonight, would be better able to describe the animal rights perspective. To me, stopping them from breeding today, as compared to killing them all off today, I don't think you're looking at more than 10, 15, at the most 20 years before they'd all be gone anyway. You know, the horses, you know, can live to be 30. So you're looking at 30 years before they're all gone. So I don't see that much of a difference. I think it would be, I guess for our pet animals, I would say, I don't see any reason to euthanize it. For animals in a factory farm setting, I think most people would say, let them live out their natural lifespans, but let's change the way that we manage them. You know, if you were going to abolish, you know, the use of any animals, that seems to me to be nicer.
But I don't know. Super expensive.
Well, you know, they do surveys of people, of consumers, and the majority of Americans would be willing to pay more for their food if they had an assurance that the animals were raised under more humane conditions.
Oh yeah, I'm just talking about if we stopped eating cows and just let them live out their life, you know, who would pay for that pastoral existence?
Oh, I don't know. Who's going to pay for my Medicare?
Well, that's, it's pretty analogous, isn't it?
Yes, but at least there's an end point when you're talking about cattle.
You know, the dropping off a sick dog to a vet is kind of like, you know, dropping off an indigent person to an emergency room if you went that guardianship.
Yes. That's right. Who's mm-hmm. going to pay for it? That's why organized veterinary medicine is opposed to guardianship language, because the veterinarians don't want to have to pay for it. You know, there's no third-party copay, or there's very little, you know, third-party in veterinary medicine.
So one of the readings talks about Europe can be a little bit more animal rights than the U.S. The U.S. is clearly animal welfareist. I'm just wondering how it plays out. I know that researchers might leave Europe because they can't, it just becomes impossible to do animal studies there. But I'm wondering,
right.
How does it play out in other worlds?
I think that that animals in animal agriculture in Europe have way better lives than those in the United States. You know, they're not confined in the same way. You know, there aren't battery cages for poultry. All the poultry or the eggs would be free range, and people still buy groceries in Europe. I mean, maybe in the same way that we couldn't understand how they paid $5 a gallon for gasoline 10 years ago, and look, we're almost there and we're surviving. So, if animal protein costs twice as much, maybe you'd make some adjustments in your budget. Animal protein would maybe become more special when you purchased it or not, depending upon other things. I remember mentioning last year when you brought up that animal scientists come to the United States because it's easier for them to do research, and my retort was, and if you wanted to do human cloning, you left the United States because it's easier to do that somewhere else. Yes.
I've always been struck by the fact that discussion of animal rights almost automatically places the animal in terms of rights on the same plane as humans.
Well, no.
If there are any theorists that say, yeah, they have rights.
Yes, what you're distinguishing between would be legal rights and moral rights. And so legal rights would be like, well, we're not going to let my dog vote. That sounds absurd. But moral rights, that these animals should be free from pain and suffering, I think moral rights makes sense to the majority of people. Yeah, my dog doesn't need to vote, but my dog, shouldn't have been beaten by its previous owner, or it shouldn't have been raised in a puppy mill.
Right, but so many of the rights theorists move immediately to this notion we have no, humans have no right to exercise any dominion over animals. And it seems to me that you can have a rights approach to what we owe animals without jettisoning the dominion notion.
Yeah, I think the distinction needs to be made between legal rights and moral rights. I'm not certain that that's been well articulated by veterinary medicine. And I don't know about the animal rights people if they've thought about distinguishing between the two either. I couldn't say. But I think that that they have moral rights is something that most people agree with. Other questions? One of the animal rights things that I'm real curious to see is, so I think that we are on a trajectory. During my 30 years in veterinary medicine, there I have seen this shift in society about the value of animals. And so I expect that there will be some animals that will actually get legal rights of some sort. And what I'm waiting to see is who's going to get it. Is it going to be the animals that are most like ourselves, so marine mammals and primates, or is it going to be endangered species, or is it going to be the animals that we share our homes with, if it's going to be our pets? Because there are legal cases that, you know, there's precedent that's been set for each of those three categories on that trajectory. And it'll be interesting, I think, to see who gets them first, because I think it's inevitable. And I'm not saying it's going to be a bad thing. But I don't know who's gonna get it first.
And what those bundles of rights would look like.
Excuse me?
And what those bundles of rights would look like.
That's right.
I mean, we have Endangered Species Act, which affords certain protections to animals. The domestic animals have certain, you couldn't just take your dog out and shoot it. I guess you could.
There are cruelty laws, right. But they still have the status of property, at least in Pennsylvania. So isn't there someone in law school in here?
I'm not in law school, but I don't know if you know the name Stephen Wise, who's a law professor in Vermont, and he has a book called Rattling the Cage, which is about primates getting, he's trying to get primates legal rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it seems as if primates are probably going to be up first, just because people are speaking for them more.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
But what would those rights look like? What does that mean?
No, that's it. That's
we stop using them in humans and animals?
Probably just like no use in laboratories. I mean, we don't eat primates, so that's not really relevant.
People don't.
I don't know who does, but hopefully.
No, not in this country.
It's called bushmeat.
Right, but bushmeat in parts of Africa and Latin America is a very important source of protein in the human diet.
Well, they actually have primates.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're talking about African law, but. I think in America, nobody eats primates.
We don't have any wild
so
primates
in this
country.
So they have a different moral status in America than they do elsewhere? I don't think
that's a legal system or something.
Legal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, are animal rights, I guess they are against hunting?
No, there would be, there are laws that probably pertain, the Fish and Wildlife Service has laws, the Department of Agriculture in different states, the Fish and Game Commission. But I think that there are laws that regulate hunting, like certain lands where you can't do it, and certain time periods when you can't do it, and certain species that you can't do at all.
But animal rights advocates aren't against hunting?
Oh, of course they are.
But what's their argument for other carnivores then?
We've never eaten it ever again.
What's their argument?
For other carnivores.
Are we a carnivore?
Oh, but
we're an omnivore.
We could be, though. One could live a healthy life without using animal products, maybe. The reason I'm saying maybe is because, in terms of leading a healthy life, there are certain medications and medical procedures that exist as a result of having used animals in the past, or maybe are derived from animals today. I don't know. I guess they have synthetic insulin, but. Would an animal rights person forego treating their diabetes because of the research that was done on animals for the, I don't know.
It's not just that. For example, when you had an accident, you go to the emergency room, all the procedures from the emergency rooms mm-hmm. come from that research, for animals and for humans.
Mm-hmm.
We had a blood bank for dogs, cats, we genetic engineering now they are trying to engineer a deer that can be hunted and can respond to a special environment so the hunters can get it easier.
But they're going to glow in the dark or
something. So I don't know. With the technology that we have, it's just like the dichotomy between what is now, like somebody die and leave your wealth to your dog.
I was just reading that the number of estates that are being left to animals is increasing.
So
in the very same little, maybe we subscribe to the same kind of listserv or something, but I also read just like in the last couple of weeks about a woman who is a Christian Scientist, so can't get a blood transfusion, and apparently the military has been able to use cow blood that can be used for transfusion purposes, and they gave it to her and saved her life. She was in Australia. And it doesn't require refrigeration, has a 10-year shelf life. Mm. Made from cow. I don't remember what the procedure is. I'll see if I can send you the link.
So now you have cows who are hooked up to machines taking their blood.
There were a lot of animals that they were going to milk and get drugs from.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. I appear to have pizza coming in a video. So I don't need to turn this off. This is just in there and it's yours.
Okay. Can I post it?
Yeah, fabulous. And the tape recorder will still be on?